for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Saturday's 7.8 magnitude quake in Nepal is now estimated to have taken nearly 4,000 lives. It represents the worst earthquake the region has seen in more than 80 years. As rescue operations ramp up, challenges in reaching affected areas and providing enough aid are becoming clear. Here to talk about the earthquake and its aftermath, Bill Leith of the U.S. Geological Survey, Andrea Koppel of Mercy Corps, and Joel Achenbach of The Washington Post. But first, joining us by phone from Kathmandu, Nepal, is Brad Kerner, International Public Health Specialist and Aid Worker for Save the Children. He's currently on the ground in Kathmandu, aiding in the relief effort. And Brad, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
Brad, tell us what the scene in Kathmandu looks like today.
And the scene is incredibly sad to see. It's, besides the physical damage, red brick buildings have fallen. 16th century landmark sites have also fallen. It's so sad, though, to see the emotional side of what's going on. The earthquake is over, and the frequency of those aftershocks are decreasing. But the tension of the people, it's rising. You can feel it. People are worried. You know, they're worried about food, about safe water, where they're sleeping tonight. Everyone's on the streets. Everyone's camping out in parks. And, you know, there's a sense of fear. People do not want to go back inside, and it's palpable. You can feel it.
Does it seem as though there's lots of aid getting through into the area?
Yes, from what I understand, there is aid coming in from India and from China. I hear right now, actually, above ground, you can tell the difference between the commercial planes and the cargo planes. I can hear a cargo plane coming in right now. The airport has been very busy. So aid is getting in. I don't know exactly what type of aid and how, but I do know that the children has been able to even truck some supplies over from India and from our other warehouses that we pre-positioned supplies here in Nepal.
What is the Nepalese government itself doing now?
Well, even this morning, Save the Children was participating in and supporting the government in coordination efforts. So the government's taking the lead. They have a lot of strong partners like Save the Children. You know, they have designated 11 most hit districts and are coordinating who's going where and what's happening. Save the Children will be taking the lead in three of those districts. And we already have teams out there. Starting to the distribution, and then the various sector ministries, the health, protection, education, they're having their own coordination meetings, trying to drill down what are those really thematic needs that all the whole population needs, and we bring that lens of really what do children need.
Brad, are survivors still being found?
From what I understand and what I'm hearing, there are. I don't have as much access to the news as you and probably everyone else in America has. So I'm not seeing the images and I'm not getting the blow-by-blow, minute-by-minute. But people have not given up. They're still trying to find survivors, and it's mostly with their hands. You know, I have an amazing story of a Save the Children staff person who worked with his own neighborhood association and dug out 10 people yesterday. And they were able to do this because they prepared for a disaster over these last 3 years, saving money, buying hard hats, buying shovels, thinking that one day there would be a big earthquake or an emergency. And because of that, they were able to save 10 people. Four of them were children.
That's just an incredible story. What about communications, Brad? You say we know more than you do, but what about internal communications there?
It's been very hard communications. You know, most people, I think Nepali people themselves are communicating via SMS. The phone network goes in and out. But the communication in terms of the recovery efforts outside of Kathmandu in the rural district has been challenging to get up-to-date information because of, you know, a lack of a really strong communication system and, you know, the infrastructure being destroyed a bit. So, you know, we can expect numbers and the death toll to rise when we get more information from these rural areas.
We have the latest numbers were about 3,700 people who died. What do you want to tell Americans now as to what they can do, what we can do to help?
Yeah, great. Well, you know, the first thing is to go onto our website, SaveTheChildren.org. We have up-to-date information of what our response is, ways people can help and donate. And they will see that even now what's happening is we are buying the materials that people need right now, the tarps to sleep under. So it rained last night. It was cold last night. Me, everyone here in Nepal, we all slept outside. It's where we feel the safest.
Brad Kerner.
You know, babies, infants are sleeping under tarps with their mothers and have blankets so they are warm. We want to make sure there's food and especially clean water. We're very concerned that lack of clean water, there could be an outbreak of disease at any moment. We need to keep the sanitation and the hygiene up. And the, you know, one other thing that's really important to Save the Children is that emotional well-being. Children are traumatized. Now they'll be traumatized next week, next month, next year. And if you allow me, I have one other story. I talked to a mother today. And me personally, I have three kids under the age of 7, so this really resonated with me. This mother had a 7-year-old child. Last night, there were 3 aftershocks while we were sleeping, small ones. But even the small ones are re-traumatizing for these children. And he said, Mama, why is Mother Earth being so cruel to us? When will this stop? You know, people are scared, and we want to be here working with children in the long term to help them bounce back from this trauma.
Brad Kerner, thank you so very much for the work you're doing. Brad Kerner is International Public Health Specialist and aid worker for Save the Children. Thank you again, Brad, and please be safe.
Thank you, Diane. Appreciate that.
All right. And turning now to you, Andrea Koppel, tell me about the aid efforts that Mercy Corps is doing on the ground right now.
Absolutely, Diane. Well, Mercy Corps has one of the largest teams on the ground in Nepal. We've been there since 2005. We have over 90 people there. So immediately after the earthquake, my colleagues, none of whom suffered any loss of life, fortunately, were out doing early assessments because the most important thing is to find out what the needs are and where. Obviously, there's the search and rescue, which must take place. But then there's also, as Brad was saying, immediate emergency needs. We are right now, and we're able to source locally, water purification tablets, as Brad said. That is incredibly important that you have water that is able to be drunk. We're sourcing also tarps and tents. People are not in their homes, even those whose homes were not damaged. They're too afraid. There have been too many aftershocks. So we need to give them shelter from the elements. We also need to give them hygiene kits, soap, towels, toothbrushes, pots and pans so that people can cook. These are the kinds of things that we're looking to source locally, and where absolutely necessary, we'll be bringing them in from places like India, China, and other nearby locations. But the most important thing is that people are donating to try to support this effort because, as you've mentioned, the needs are tremendous.
And I must say, just getting these items to the people in the rural areas must be so difficult.
Absolutely. I had the great pleasure of visiting Mercy Corps' programs in Nepal 2 years ago and was in Kathmandu and traveled outside of the capital as well. And the roads are not good under the best of circumstances. We know that the airport has reopened. Fortunately, it was just closed for a brief period of time. So the important thing is to have the network of responders. Mercy Corps is working with our partners, the Nepal Red Cross, which also has a network throughout the country, so that we are doing our best to make sure that the assistance, the life-saving assistance, gets to the people who need it as quickly as possible.
Andrea Couple, she's Vice President of Global Engagement and Policy for Mercy Corps. Short break. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. From Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems, in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
As we continue our discussion about the devastating earthquake in Nepal, we have here in the studio Bill Leith. He's with the U.S. Geological Survey, Joel Achenbach, science reporter for The Washington Post, and Andrea Couple of Mercy Corps. Bill Leith, turning to you, give us a sense of just how rare this kind of earthquake actually is in that region.
Really good question. What's happening in the area of the Himalayas is the motion of the Indian subcontinent into Asia. It's a plate boundary that underlies all of the Himalayas, and these two big pieces of the Earth's crust,
the tectonic plates,
are converging at something like 2 inches a year. But they don't move smoothly at 2 inches a year. They move statically in large earthquakes. There have been many, many large earthquakes along this Himalayan front, and historic earthquakes in the area of Saturday's earthquake as well. So they're rare in the sense that we've seen very large earthquakes like this 2-3 times a century, and yet they're a persistent feature of the plate boundary.
So in fact, they are. It's a hazardous area at best.
It is a hazardous area. It's been identified as a hazardous area for a long time. And in fact, Kathmandu itself has been identified as one of the most earthquake-prone cities in the world.
Pretty bad stuff.
Pretty bad. And now this earthquake, unfortunately, was a direct hit on Kathmandu. The epicenter of the quake was about 50 miles to the northwest, but the earthquake faulting ruptured right underneath the city of Kathmandu. I can't imagine a worse situation.
And turning to you, Joel Achenbach, structurally, Kathmandu is vulnerable as well.
Oh, yeah. So the orthodoxy is that earthquakes don't kill people. Buildings kill people. And this horrible event, is dismaying as a reporter to see those bulletins on Saturday, because we have written, on the front page of our newspaper, and everyone has written, that Kathmandu was very vulnerable to a major earthquake. This is in 2010, after the big earthquake in Haiti, we did a story on all the cities around the world that are sitting in these seismically hazardous places. And we mentioned Kathmandu very prominently because it's as Bill alluded to, it's right there at the Himalayan front. It's sitting on this old sort of lake bed. I mean, loose soils amplify the shaking. And it's a little bit like Mexico City, another city that's incredibly vulnerable because of the geology of that basin that Mexico City sits in. So you write this story and you say, hey, you could have a major disaster there. But these events don't really occur on any kind of schedule, right? I mean, you don't know when. They don't occur on the human time scale necessarily. So the last big one was 1934. And if you're living in Nepal, obviously, based on the report we heard from Brad, people were prepared. Some people were prepared with hard hats, shovels. They knew a disaster could take place. But so many people, their lives are lived in the urgency of the moment of how am I going to feed my kids, et cetera.
But what about the structures in which they live and work? To what extent? You say buildings kill people. Is that what happens?
That's exactly correct, Diane. Kathmandu is famous for having a lot of unreinforced masonry structures. Some of these historic structures that came down that we saw in the footage, like the historic tower, they're not really designed and built to withstand ground motion, severe earthquakes. And a lot of people live in apartments that sit atop a first floor that's called a soft first floor. They're open. They don't have very many reinforced walls. They're open for the merchants to be able to sell their wares. And so those buildings are very, really prone to collapse.
And Andrea, when you were there several years ago, you saw exactly that.
Absolutely. I remember walking through Bhaktapur, the ancient Newar city, and seeing these spectacular buildings that were carved out of wood. They're known for these beautiful windows and whatnot. And then seeing those spectacular ancient temples and whatnot. But what I also saw, Diane, was almost a spider's web of wires and telephone lines and whatnot that are twisted every which way, which is just paints the picture of a third world city that is in desperate need of the kind of advances that we were just hearing Joel mention. But if I could, I also would like to say that, Joel, you are 1,000% correct that we knew this was coming. So why weren't they better prepared? And the answer is, Nepal is one of the poorest countries in the world, ranked 157th out of 187. The U.S. government allots $2.5 billion, or at least that's what we would like the U.S. government to allot, to humanitarian response. In that budget, Diane, that's also supposed to be where you can get funds to do the early warning training, the disaster risk reduction that is so desperately needed in places like Nepal, the Philippines, Indonesia. And what happens? You have one emergency after another that takes the vast majority of these funds, and we must appeal to the U.S. Congress, and I hope your listeners will reach out to them now to ensure that the humanitarian assistance budget for next year is as high as possible, and that this year's, the fiscal year 15 budget, that more money is found to go to Nepal to respond to this, and that it is not taken away from other emergencies in the Central African Republic, South Sudan, Ukraine, and Yemen.
Bill Leith, what's the difference that different kinds of buildings could have made in this devastation?
We'll be learning that over the next couple of months. We do know that the unreinforced masonry buildings perform very badly. You can see a lot of that in photographs that have been posted for Kathmandu. I also have heard from engineer colleagues that I spoke with yesterday that there are some modern buildings in Kathmandu which withstood the earthquake, showing that, in fact, building earthquake shaking resistant buildings works. And also, there's a success story here related to the airport. The airport is the lifeline in and out of Kathmandu, and the airport is working is, I understand, because of work that was done to seismically strengthen it over the last few years, and that's right now during the response phase a critical
absolutely
yeah.
Joe,
just to follow up with what Bill said, people have been working on retrofitting buildings, particularly schools in Kathmandu and in Nepal, and hospitals, and as Bill mentioned, the airport. So there have been groups going back 20 years that have put a lot of effort into preparing for the big one, and now it's happened. And so one story that we'll look for is, buildings that didn't fall down, people who didn't lose their lives because of the specific efforts of some of these nonprofit and aid groups and Nepalese organizations that try to strengthen their infrastructure.
Now, I don't want to take away from the devastation that is in Nepal and Kathmandu, but it does seem to me, Joel, that we've heard that right here in this country there are vulnerable areas and vulnerable buildings.
Well, sure. I mean, we have in California, a disaster that's going to hit one of these days. We don't know when. Earthquakes are not predictable. You can make a hazard map. And in fact, we were talking before the show about how good are the hazard maps. What do they really tell you? And we know that the San Andreas Fault is capable of producing these magnitude 8 earthquakes, and that sections of that fault have not broken for 300 years. Of course, there was the big one in 1906 in San Francisco. I think there was one in 1857 in the mid portion of the fault. But there will be another big one. Now, fortunately, in this country, in places like California, the infrastructure is pretty well built in most places. The natural hazards that we're facing go beyond earthquakes. Of course, you could have a volcano, Mount Rainier, or something like that could blow, and that would be a showstopper. And we saw what happened with Katrina. People warned in advance of Katrina that there could be a massive loss of life in New Orleans because of a hurricane, and that's what happened. You look at with Hurricane Andrew in Florida. A lot of the houses that were destroyed there, the building codes were not followed, and the roof trusses were not properly built. And so when the big winds came through, it ripped the roofs off and caused a huge amount of damage there. So I guess that's a long way of saying that problems are going to happen here too. We're obviously more resilient because we're a wealthier country when it comes to a disaster.
Bill.
Yeah, Joel is absolutely right about that we've had building codes in place in the United States, adopted by almost all the states for a long time now, essentially since the San Fernando earthquake in 1971 in Southern California. But we do know that there are vulnerable building types throughout these areas for which there have been building codes for a long time. And you mentioned the soft story problem. In fact, in Los Angeles, the mayor of Los Angeles commissioned a study to look at the city's vulnerability to three different engineering problems. Soft story was one of them. And the result of that is identifying very significant risk in the Los Angeles metropolitan area for damage to soft story, for, you know, that soft first story building. And the mayor has now gone to city council asking for a remedy to this situation.
Can you explain to me how that soft story is actually constructed?
The easiest way to visualize it is to look at one of the apartment buildings that has a garage underneath. The garage is being filled up by the car or two or three that's there, and that weakens that first story because it's open. It doesn't have walls around it. And without special strengthening, those are vulnerable to collapse. That happened in 1989 in San Francisco in the earthquake there, the Loma Prieta earthquake, the one that collapsed the freeway sections and started fires in the Marina District in San Francisco. That was a soft first story problem.
Bill Eath, he's with the U.S. Geological Survey, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I do want to invite listeners to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to send us a tweet. And joining us now by phone, oh, she's not there yet. All right. We're hoping to speak with a former correspondent for The New York Times. We'll hold off on that until we have her. Andrea, does this recovery thus far look as though it compares to the way other crises are managed, or are different moves going on?
I actually worked for another aid organization in 2010 after the Haiti earthquake, which was, as you know, enormous. If we remember, the Haitian government took weeks upon weeks, some might say months, to be able to kind of put its own house in order to say what they needed. It's remarkable. In 24 hours, we are seeing the Nepali government, the home ministry, sitting down with aid organizations like Mercy Corps and others to talk through what's needed. We have gotten a list of action items that the Home Ministry has said they want from Mercy Corps.
So, very encouraging.
So it is encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And they are saying what they need are tarps and cooking pans and water and food and those kinds of things. To what extent are those survivors being able to get hold of what it is they need?
The answer is obviously not all of them. I mean, there have been entire villages that have been destroyed. And as we already discussed, the roads in Nepal are not terrific. The epicenter, as we heard Bill say, about 50 miles outside of the Kathmandu Valley. So we are in the early days of this emergency response. Life-saving emergency supplies are urgently needed, but we will be looking as quickly as possible, Diane, to get into the recovery stage, looking at how we can get money, small amounts of money, into the hands of those vulnerable Nepalis who were affected by the earthquake so they can then buy what they need in their local markets. One of the biggest, should we say, really problems with so much emergency response these days is that people are always looking to fly in supplies instead of looking at what is available in the local markets, in the local communities, because then what you have is communities that are hit with a double and triple whammy because the markets often are open. We're hearing that shop owners are opening their stalls and they want to be able to sell things so that there is an economic recovery.
All right. And after a short break, we will open the phones and take your calls. I look forward to hearing from you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Maine Office of Tourism, which offers travelers an opportunity to explore and discover their main thing, to be inspired, be adventurous, and be yourself. The journey begins at visitmaine.com. From Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Kate Mulgrew starred as Captain Janeway in Star Trek Voyager and currently plays Red on the hit show Orange is the New Black. In a new memoir, she opens up about her difficult childhood and the baby she gave up for adoption. The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. Many phone calls, many emails concerned about not only Nepal, but the United States. One email from Dana, who says, is it advisable to go to Nepal to help?
Well, first of all, thank you, Dana, for your concern. And I think that there are a lot of people who think that way, and we appreciate the sentiment. No, it is not advisable. The best thing that people can do is to give to aid organizations like Mercy Corps, which have experienced emergency responders on the ground right now. We've been there since 2005. We know the people, the communities, and can get assistance to the people as quickly as possible.
Here's a tweet from Mary. Can your guests comment on the potential danger to the Northwest U.S. and Cascadia, Bill?
Right. Yeah, we have our own plate boundaries all along the West Coast and up into Alaska and out along the Aleutian Islands. And one of them is the subduction zone that we call Cascadia that drops down where the Juan de Fuca plate is dropping down underneath Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. We know from studies of historic earthquakes there that plate boundary is capable of magnitude 9 earthquakes. And in fact, we know that it generated a magnitude 9 earthquake in 1700. Recent studies are showing that magnitude 8 earthquakes around the size of the one that hit in Nepal on Saturday, that those may occur every 600 years in part of that subduction zone. It's a place where we're monitoring the earthquakes very carefully, where we're working with the states of Washington, Oregon, and, of course, California very closely, where those states have implemented tsunami warning plans because, of course, that plate boundary is underwater. And earthquakes of that size would almost certainly generate local tsunamis. So yes, that's a major concern, a major hazardous zone in the U.S.
And of course, Joel Achenbach, there has been a lot of talk recently about the fracking going on in Oklahoma and the earthquakes we've seen there.
That's right. So human-induced earthquakes is sort of a new topic that we weren't talking about much 5-10 years ago, but it's a big topic now because they inject the liquids from the fracking process down into the depleted reservoirs, and this has been triggering, I believe, and Bill can answer this better, magnitude 4-5 earthquakes roughly in that zone. So not giant showstopper magnitude 8 earthquakes or even 7s, but this is, you know, something that the seismologists have been discussing a lot in recent weeks.
How closely are you watching what's happening there, Bill?
Oh, extremely closely. Of course, you know, there's great public and media interest, also congressional interest in those induced earthquakes. Just to give an example, in Oklahoma, between 1970 and about 2000, there were two or three earthquakes a year that had a magnitude 3 or larger. So far this year, in the first 3 months of this year, we're talking about two or three earthquakes of that size a day. So it's a 100-fold increase, 300-fold increase in the number of earthquakes of magnitude 3 and larger in Oklahoma.
USGS, but those are all small, correct?
They are mostly small. The largest occurred in 2011 in Oklahoma, magnitude 5.6 earthquake.
Okay,
but we are having damaging earthquakes. They're not devastating earthquakes, but we're having earthquakes in the magnitude 4 range that are cracking the foundations of houses, cracked courthouse foundation in Cherokee, Oklahoma, and so even though these are small and maybe discounted as small, the thing to realize is that a large number of small earthquakes greatly increases the probability of a larger earthquake.
That's what we're concerned about.
We're concerned about another earthquake in the magnitude 5 to 6 range in these states.
Small earthquakes can and do lead to larger earthquakes.
That's the rule of thumb.
All right. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to John in Louisville, Kentucky. You're on the air.
Hello. I haven't heard you all mention the New Madrid Fault, which runs pretty much right between Louisville and St. Louis. And the last time there was a major earthquake here, the population was much smaller, and there were probably no tall buildings at all. And so if there's a possibility of, you know, a lot of devastation.
Bill.
Yes, absolutely. There were three large earthquakes in the magnitude 7 range in 1811 and 1812. New Madrid is in the area around the larger cities of Memphis and St. Louis. And there is persistent low-level seismicity in that area since then that indicate the potential for a larger earthquake there. Now, I mentioned that building codes, and most of the U.S. states have adopted earthquake-resistant building codes for new construction. So our concerns are two. One is that for older constructions, those codes are not retroactive, and there's a lot of course, older construction in that part of the country. And then Second is that counties, local jurisdictions, cities can opt out of those seismic provisions, and they can choose not to implement them. And that, for example, the city of Memphis right now is struggling with a decision about whether to implement the building code provisions for earthquakes.
Interesting. But, Joe.
Let me just add one note, John, that it's true that past earthquakes can tell you that you could have them in the future, too. But some powerful earthquakes can happen on return times of several thousand years. So there's no historical record of the last big one in certain places. And the idea that some places are really super high risk and other places are completely invulnerable and don't have to worry about it at all, I don't think that's exactly true. So, for example, New York City, you don't think of that as an earthquake zone, but it has a lot of unreinforced masonry structures that would be vulnerable in a seismic event, a big one. And could you have one there? Well, you know, we have an expert here from the USGS who could answer that. I don't think you could rule it out. Isn't that true?
No, you can't rule it out. And in fact, we do have historic evidence of earth damaging large earthquakes off of the coast of Boston, Grand Banks earthquake off the coast of Nova Scotia, and earthquakes in the magnitude 5-6 range in New York.
All right, I want to bring us back to Nepal. Here's an email from Patricia in New York. She says, after a natural disaster, when children are separated from parents, human trafficking is a particular risk. Nepali girls are at risk. Many are sent to brothels in India, others to carpet factories. What's being done on the ground now to intercept traffickers who take advantage of crisis? Andrea.
Mercy Corps does not work in the trafficking space, but I can tell you that we do work with youth. I am sure that there are organizations like Save the Children and others that are focusing very much on what we call protection issues.
And that's what I wanted to ask you. Give me a sense of how Mercy Corps does its work, how Save the Children does its work, Doctors Without Borders. We have all these different organizations, and people say, to whom shall I give? To which organization?
I think people need to use their good judgment and go on to our websites. I would welcome them to go to mercycorps.org to see the work that we do.
Such as
Mercy Corps is one of the top emergency responders in the world. But we have distinguished ourselves, Diane, because not only do we do the emergency response, but we are looking to transition as quickly as possible to early recovery, to help people rebuild their livelihoods. We work with youth. We work with women. We work with farmers. We have been doing a lot of work outside of Kathmandu in the western part of Nepal in disaster risk reduction, early warnings, building up river embankments so that there isn't the terrible flooding. Remember, Nepal is known as one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to flooding every year. Thousands of lives are lost. So people need to use their
good judgment. Absolutely.
To learn about organizations like Mercy Corps and others.
Do you want to comment, Bill?
Not on that subject.
Okay.
No, thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go back to the phones and let's see, to Lewis in DeKalb, Illinois. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I'm a college student from Chile, another earthquake-prone country. And my question was that after the earthquake in Haiti, we saw countries like the United States sending troops to Haiti, and also Brazil sending troops to Haiti. We had the earthquake in Chile in 2010. Chile was very hesitant in trying to get aid from other countries. I think seeing what had happened in Haiti, what is happening in Nepal now with the fear probably of them thinking that India is going to take over or China is going to take over the assessment of the earthquake. Is there like an organization that oversees that, a UN organization that oversees that? So Nepal, since it's in a very fragile state, doesn't fall into this.
What do you think, Andrea?
The Nepali government, as I had mentioned earlier, is absolutely responding, in charge, working with aid partners like Mercy Corps and the United Nations and others to make the assessments that they need. I don't think we need to worry about what the caller just mentioned.
I'm glad to hear that. You wanted to add something about earthquakes.
Well, what's on my mind is not directly on this topic, but there are two things that we've been trying to make sure the information available to the people who are responding to the earthquake. And one is about aftershocks. And there have been a couple of very large aftershocks in the magnitude 6 range in the last couple of days. We've issued a forecast for aftershocks. It's on the webpage for the earthquake. And we're expecting... just statistically, earthquakes are pretty well behaved statistically. We're expecting aftershocks above magnitude 6 in the next week. And again, in the next year, these aftershocks will go on for weeks and months and up to a year. And imagine that you're on a search and rescue team you're in a building that's partially collapsed or these are of very significant concern. For their response.
Here's a fascinating question from a listener, and I don't know whether anyone here can answer it. How much height did the Himalayas gain from this earthquake? Can you answer that, Bill?
Not quantitatively. And actually, we'll be learning this. There is a set of a dozen GPS receivers that are in Nepal that we'll be recovering data from and get very precise data from that. But because the fault on which the earthquake occurred is nearly horizontal, it really wasn't about vertical gain of the Himalayas.
I see.
It was a motion. The maximum motion on the fault was at the epicenter was a few meters, but it was mainly horizontal motion.
I see. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You wanted to comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thought, which is that the outpouring of compassion is great because of this disaster in Nepal. And obviously, a lot of Americans have connection there because of trekking and going to Everest and so on. This is going to happen again in another big city like Mexico City or Caracas or Tehran, Istanbul. There's a lot of these cities that are in these extremely seismically hazardous places. And one of our sources at the Post, Brian Tucker, has always said, let's put 10% of our relief money toward prevention of future disasters by, and I think Andrea alluded to it a minute ago about just shoring up the sides of this infrastructure in these places that are vulnerable. It's not as dramatic to do prevention, but it saves lives, you know, and we know another big one is going to come. And so if we could put some resources towards places like Mexico City just to help them retrofit some of those buildings, we know that would have a real consequence.
Andrea.
Diane, in 2011, less than 5% of all U.S. funding for humanitarian assistance went to disaster risk reduction to prevention. Here's a statistic, or here's a figure for you. Between 1980 and 2013, so about the last 30 years, disasters cost the global economy $38 trillion. Cities that Joel just referred to are the engines of these, of all countries, but fragile countries' economies. If we do not invest in the disaster risk recovery, in the early warning systems, in the prevention to build the resilience of these fragile countries, we are spending so much more money in the emergency response. We could be saving the American taxpayers millions, if not billions of dollars a year if we just invested in prevention.
And you would agree, I would think, Bill.
Absolutely, absolutely. The loss reduction is through mitigating the potential damage from the earthquakes.
But do we see that in places other than California right now? Do we see it in other places around the world?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the top example is in Japan. Japan just withstood a magnitude 9 earthquake, a 20-meter high tsunami, and the system, the requirements for safe construction in Japan resulted in relatively few losses, relatively few economic losses, fatalities from the earthquake itself. The tsunami was a different story, but that investment that they've made over the last several decades had really paid off for them.
And on that note, we'll have to leave it. Bill Leith of the U.S. Geological Survey, Andrea Koppel of Mercy Corps, Joel Achenbach of The Washington Post. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted.